Case number 20-6078, in the case of Wendy Browning et al. Versus Edmondson County, Kentucky et al. Arguments not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Smith, for the appellant, you may proceed.
Morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court, Mr. Belsley. My name is Aaron Smith. On behalf of the appellants, Edmondson County Sheriff's Deputy Jordan Jones and Edmondson County Sheriff Shane Doyle. This appeal concerns Deputy Jones' entitlement to the protection of qualified immunity and the entitlement of both Jones and Sheriff Doyle to qualified official immunity as to state law claims arising out of a police pursuit which occurred on February 27, 2018 in Edmondson County, Kentucky, a rural county in the area if you're not familiar with it. I intend this morning to briefly address jurisdiction, then address the Fourth Amendment excessive force claim against Deputy Jones, and finally the Kentucky state law claims of negligence. With regard to jurisdiction, it's well established that this court has jurisdiction to hear this appeal from the denial of a motion for summary judgment asserting claims of immunity. You have jurisdiction to review de novo the legal application of immunity, and so we are here today. Moving on to the Fourth Amendment claim, Your Honor, which arises out of the use of a taser by Deputy Jones following the pursuit, our position is that Deputy Jones is entitled to qualified immunity with regard to his use of the taser on the minor CS. As the court is aware, I'll briefly review the facts. Following the collision of the vehicle, Deputy Jones approached CS in the back of the wrecked vehicle. Saw him leaned over with his hands concealed in front of him, moving back and forth. Jones commanded CS to show his hands. CS ignored those commands, so Deputy Jones broke out the rear window and deployed his taser once, using no other force.
Can I ask you less about the facts and more about just the background?
Sure.
The rule? I found our case law a little inconsistent on what active resistance means. I found some cases that defined it to include merely disobeying a police officer's order, which, if that were the test, presumably would help you here because he did say, show me your hands, and even though he was unconscious, of course, he disobeyed. But then we have other cases suggesting that there's a distinction between active resistance and passive resistance. And I would think, I don't know how you would define passive resistance, but I would think that this would fall within that category. So if that kind of rule principle applied here, it'd seem...
Sure. I think the case that was instructive that we've briefed on is Thomas versus City of East Point, where an individual was walking away from officers. This court actually said, hey, we're in kind of a gray area with our case law here on resistance. And so the test that I have found is that there has to be noncompliance and something more. The something more here being noncompliance with orders and then the act, as Deputy Jones at least observed it, of concealing of hands and of moving back and forth. And so I think you have both noncompliance and active resistance in that the movement that he observed in the vehicle, not showing the hands and actively moving to, as he viewed it, conceal his hands. Does that address Your Honor's question?
Yeah, I guess so, but I that suggests that there really isn't much room for passive resistance because, I mean, he was unconscious, so obviously he wasn't doing anything.
Well, Deputy Jones, of course, didn't know at the time
that
he was unconscious.
I understand that, but just factually he was unconscious, so.
And he did observe movement as well, whatever that movement may have been.
Any type of minor movements would qualify as active resistance?
I believe so, especially in this circumstance where he knows that ammunition's been thrown from the vehicle. He has at least a reasonable belief that someone in that vehicle could be armed, and he has hands that he can't see, and he sees someone moving in the back seat. I think you combine those factors and that.
Do you think it would be a different case if there was no allegation of the fact that he may be armed?
It potentially might, candidly. I think the belief of being armed raises the level of concern for an officer for his safety in that scenario. And that's, of course, an important factor for the court as well under the established case law. If he can see hands, there's no concern of a weapon, that might be a different scenario than a scenario where I've been told ammunition's been thrown out of the window, I've got concealed hands.
But the difference between active and inactive, if it's going to be a difference, has got to take into account that you could have something, but you're not actively... what you're describing as active seem passive to me. Not moving, not saying, not responding.
Well,
that's passive by definition. You know, it's actually doing something. Now, I can see you can say rocking is maybe doing something, but it's hard to see how rocking is threatening.
Well, I think what he did, sir, was not only rocking, but being hunched over.
You can be very passively hunched over.
You could, Your Honor, of course.
I understand. So if there's a threat, I thought the idea of the clearly established rule was that you can't just tase somebody because there's a possible threat. It's got to be kind of in motion. And I don't know. What did the court assume the facts were?
Excuse me, Your Honor.
What did the district court assume the facts were with respect to perceiving a threat?
The district court recognized that there was movement and that there was reasonable belief of a weapon in the vehicle and that there was noncompliance with orders. I think that's where the district court left it. There was not a significant...
That's kind of what we're stuck with as facts, right?
They are, yes, Your Honor.
Movement.
Some movement. And I do think this case, as I said, falls in that same area of Thomas v. City of East Point, where you have active resistance where someone has a weapon or is brandishing or is coming after an officer, and then you have a situation where someone's simply not doing what they're told. This is in that middle gray area.
All these cases are so fact-dependent. Obviously, Thomas was the case where the individual is walking away, correct? So there was some activity there, and then the walking away could be deemed fleeing under the third Graham factor. That factor would not be relevant here because obviously CS was not fleeing. So isn't it distinguishable on that basis? I mean, in any case that I've seen the party cite, in some respects, is distinguishable.
I don't know that there is a case on point, which goes to our argument about whether this is a clearly established right or not. And that's a whole different set of issues about is there a clearly established right not to be tased in this scenario. I haven't found a case exactly on point. We would have pointed it out to the court if we had. And so that goes to that argument, of course, as well, which we have set out in our briefs.
So you made reference to ammunition and the officer's belief that perhaps CS was concealing a handgun under him as he was semi-conscious or unconscious. Why is that a reasonable belief from the officer's perspective, objectively? Is it just because there was ammunition, the officer had received information that ammunition was thrown from the vehicle, and I think maybe even a gun was thrown from the vehicle as well. But the officer did not see any weapon in the vehicle, did not see a weapon anywhere near CS,
of course, this was a chaotic scene immediately after an accident. He was told about the ammunition. The issue of the gun, in all fairness to the record, did not come out until later in depositions from one of the plaintiffs. So he was not told anything about a gun, simply the ammunition. Your Honor, I would argue that it's a reasonable belief from an officer in his standpoint, a vehicle fleeing in this scenario, and ammunition's thrown out, his mind has to go to, there's ammunition, there's likely a gun in that vehicle. And so I think it's a reasonable belief that you have someone concealing hands in the back seat, that could be a weapon.
Can I ask you, what is that? I find this issue very significant because I do think that if it was reasonable, that makes this case very different than if it was unreasonable. Is that a fact question or a legal question? Taking the historical facts and asking the question, was an officer reasonable in thinking that this person might have a weapon? Is that a legal question that we would decide because it's just objective, or is it a question that should be for the jury or for genuine issue of material fact?
I believe that's a legal question, Your Honor, because we're not disputing what the facts were and what he observed or didn't observe, and he has testified as to what his belief was, and so that's a fact of record. Now, I think the court can take that on its face and then apply immunity to that. Were his actions objectively reasonable in light of the situation that presented itself and what he has said he observed and what his thoughts were? So I think you can hear that.
I could certainly see how certain things would clearly be unreasonable as a matter of law and certain things would be clearly reasonable as a matter of law. In between, where we're drawing legal lines, if where the law should draw the line is arguably, some people would say it's clear from the precedent on these facts, and others would say not. We have to resolve that.
Of course, Your Honor. And that goes again back to, was the right here clearly established? And that's a significant issue that we've raised for the court. Any other questions on the Fourth Amendment issue? I want to make sure I address everything with Your Honors.
No.
Okay. Thank you. I'll move on briefly in my time that I have left. We believe that both Deputy Jones and Sheriff Doyle are entitled to qualified official immunity on the state law claims. With regard to Sheriff Doyle, the claims are based on his supervision of the pursuit. Our position is that his actions were discretionary. There's no policy in place that said that he must supervise in some particular way or that he must put some particular policy in place. And we've cited you to the case of Walker v. Davis on that point, and we think that that's pretty controlling. And the case law on that is clear. With regard to Deputy Jones, his actions in choosing to begin, continue, and end the pursuit were discretionary. The policy does not tell him how to go about those things. It gives him guidelines that he should consider, but it does not say you shall begin and end the pursuit in any particular way. And we've set out those arguments.
Those cases that are cited against you on that issue.
What's that, Your Honor?
I don't have the names right here. How do you distinguish the cases, the Kentucky cases that are decided against you?
The Mattingly and Browder cases, Your Honor.
How do you distinguish those cases?
So, a couple of things. Those are unpublished cases for what that's worth.
These are unpublished Court of Appeals? Or
correct. Court of Appeals, Your Honor.
They're not even precedent within.
Correct, Your Honor. Secondly, I would add the policies in those cases were more stringent on the officers as to what they had to do and when.
We determine, for you would say, whether something's discretionary or not for Kentucky qualified immunity purposes based on the policies. Is that where the discretion comes, or
well,
sort of the nature of the act, or where? How does Kentucky law distinguish between?
Kentucky,
you're suggesting it just depends on what policy that particular county has.
No, Kentucky law at baseline says the act of supervision is discretionary unless there is a policy that says otherwise.
I see.
And that's the distinguishing factor.
Could you address the? You argue before us that the battery claim is subject to qualified immunity. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Did you argue that below?
I did. We raised it at page 25 of our brief below, Your Honor.
Of your brief below?
Yes, I believe we did.
That's your summary judgment brief?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you, Counsel. You'll have your 3 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Please the court, my friend and learned counsel, Aaron Smith. You're right, Judge Murphy. There's a fact issue that surrounds whether the force was excessive or not. The discussion that you had with my learned counsel would almost seem to suggest that there was a minor accident or even a traffic stop that preceded the tasing. The facts show that there was a horrific collision, and the court's been provided photographs of that almost bent this car into an inverted C. Immediately following that collision, Officer Jones approached the driver with his gun drawn, told him to get out of the car, and then punched him in the face. This was before he got out of the car. There was a young female juvenile passenger in the front seat who had taken the full brunt of that collision, and how she survived, no one knows.
They were in the car that was hit by the other car.
Yes, sir.
Presumably it was the fault in some sense of the car that got hit because it was going so fast.
Well, we don't assert any fault against the...
I'm just trying to understand what the nature of it is.
Yeah.
The car that we know was going too fast was the car being hit.
Right, right.
Thank you. That's all I'm asking.
That's correct, Your Honor. So, after punching the driver and then with the help of EMS pulling him out of the car and cuffing him, he runs around the other, the damaged side of the car, claims that he doesn't see the female passenger in the front seat, sees the young man in the back, who he admits may have been unconscious. He testified to that under oath, breaks the window and tases him. Now, as the court properly recognized, the question is, was there noncompliance with something more? We acknowledge there was noncompliance. He was unconscious. He couldn't comply. But was there something more sufficient to justify what this officer did, that this officer actually processed and made a part of his decision-making? Or was this, as we have seen again and again and again, a situation where an officer is adrenalized from a pursuit at speeds of up to 130 miles an hour that took place over 10 to 12 minutes, went through 219 intersections, driveways, and so on, came out and simply did not have his reactions under control?
Well, let me ask you, counsel, I mean, is the test, I know we've got this fact-law distinction, obviously, in terms of what we can review at this point, but is the test one of objective reasonableness in terms of Deputy Sheriff Jones? And I ask this because I think that the facts are established at this point that the officer did ask CS or order CS to show his hands. So there was some directive to CS, whether CS could hear it, process it, or not in his condition, we don't know. But there was a request or a demand from the officer, right, to take action, to show hands which were apparently concealed under CS's body.
That's what he says, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, how do we construe that at this juncture?
Well, Your Honor,
is that a fact that we accept as true at this point? Is that in dispute?
No, I wouldn't go that far, Judge. I believe that an objective reasonableness issue oftentimes, as in this case, is something that is responsibly assigned to a jury to resolve. A jury can decide whether it's objectively unreasonable or not because there are contested facts. The fact is to whether his prior conduct before he gets to CS indicates whether he was operating simply on reasonable police judgment or whether he had lost all sense of that and was simply too wound up to make proper decisions. I believe Judge Stivers, particularly considering the law that the court has discussed this morning where it's a little bit gray, what is, you know, it's passive or it's non-compliance plus something else. Well, what is something else?
What concerns me the most in this case is the weapon and whether it was objectively reasonable. You argue for the test that passive resistance wouldn't be enough, but that's only one of the Graham factors. Officer safety is also another factor. And in a lot of the cases, there was no concern with officer safety when the court held that passive resistance is not enough. It seems to me that it's almost a balancing. It's a balancing of threats to the officer and the types of actions that the, in this case, the plaintiff or the suspect took. And so when you say that the threats to the officer are increased because there's a potential weapon, that would suggest to me that the amount of resistance would need to decrease before you would, I would give you the hypothetical, what if it was the same case, but he saw the person, he was conscious, and he just had a gun in his lap. And he said, put down your gun, show me your hands, and he did nothing. I would say that's passive resistance because he just did nothing. But I would think tasing in that circumstance would seem reasonable to me.
Well, I Your Honor, I don't know that I would agree with you because the court has said, in, for example, in the Correa versus Simone case, I'm sorry, in this Sixth Circuit, mere possession of a gun does not warrant tasing unless coupled with something more, such as a physical or verbal action.
Yeah, but I went into something, and that case is distinguishable on its facts because the plaintiff in that case suggested that the officer told him to get down on his knees and put his hands up, and he did exactly that, and he still got tased.
Right.
There was non-compliance in this case in a way that there was not non-compliance in that one.
Right.
And so there's something more here would be the show me your hands, and he didn't,
When it comes to the gun, and this is important, Officer Jones said he heard before the collision that ammunition had been found somewhere along the route of the pursuit. He did not know there was a gun in the car. Now, he may have assumed that, but that only came out in the testimony of the female passenger who said that at some point during the pursuit, the driver threw a gun out the window. So he, at most, Officer Jones reasonably believed that perhaps ammunition had been thrown out of the vehicle. But there's two questions there. Is that enough to justify the tasing? The other question is, the fact that ammunition is thrown out of the vehicle, is that suggestive, and should the officer have taken into account the idea that that suggested that they were getting rid of means by which to resist an arrest or things of that nature? I think if you look at that photograph, there's no question but that the occupants of that vehicle, with perhaps the exception of the driver who was on the other side of the car that was impacted, were seriously injured. The idea that a police officer, a law enforcement officer, having witnessed that collision and seen the aftermath, instead of offering aid to those involved in the collision, would run to the other side, break out a window, and inflict pain on a possibly unconscious juvenile, I just think is shocks the conscience, and it's unconscionable.
Clarifying, just real quick, I thought that some testimony suggested CS was sitting behind the driver. Am I just mistaken on that, and it's undisputed that CS was sitting behind the passenger?
That he was seated behind the driver?
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
So why would he run around to the other side? I'm just a little confused. If CS was behind the driver, then the blunt of the impact was on the passenger side. So,
well, Your Honor, you may be correct. My thought on that may be wrong. He may not have run to the other side. But in the course of removing Mr. Embry from the vehicle, I don't see how he could have missed the teenage passenger in the front seat. The whole time, and if Your Honor's correct, he's got a clear view of this individual right there. He can tell whether he's moving or not. Does he remain huddled over like this the whole time that he's removing Mr. Embry? Because there's this claim that CS was moving. Well, Officer Jones said that could have been a result of the car moving. I don't think CS was moving at all. CS was unconscious. And again, that's another thing that the jury could take into account, and that's why Judge Stivers properly said, I'm going to let folks involved from the community that through which this chase took place resolve that issue.
Can I ask something about the breaking of the window? Why presumably was the window broken? And how much later was the tasing?
I couldn't get at him otherwise.
Why did you need to get at him? Question him or what?
Our position is there was no need to get at him. He was a severely injured, unconscious juvenile in the back of a car, Judge, and nobody had any business doing anything to him except EMS, getting him out of that car without exacerbating his injuries. Both these young people ended up being life-flighted.
You would say a jury could find that breaking the window was actually contributed to the idea that he wasn't a threat.
Could be, Your Honor. I mean, there are a lot of facts here, which Judge Stiver said, I think they're genuine, I think a jury ought to resolve them. And that was the point of our complaint on jurisdiction. Now, when it comes to the discretionary issues, Officer Jones has testified that if presented with the same circumstances tonight, he would pursue a car with an unbelted passenger in it at speeds of up to 130 miles an hour because it's got an unilluminated license plate, unless somebody tells him not to do it. His sheriff hasn't told him not to do it. His sheriff says, I don't tell my guys how to do anything. I trust them to do the right thing. Their policy says, and is very specific, when the seriousness of the offense is outweighed by the risk to the public that was presented by this chase, you shall terminate the pursuit. And there's absolutely no balancing on that issue at all. You've got a man that's being pursued for a unilluminated license plate, and because he's got an unbelted passenger in the car.
When Jones got into this, he was always already going fast.
He was. He was, Your Honor, but that's...
By going fast, he committed a lot worse crime than driving with an unilluminated plate.
Well, Your Honor...
Is that true?
I agree with you. You're not going to...
I'm just asking.
No, you raise an important point. I'm not here to make any apologies for Mr. Embry. What he did was stupid. But like our expert said, we pay our police to be the adult in the room.
Right, and exercise discretion. Adults exercise discretion, thank God, you know.
Well, you've got a choice here. You've got somebody that you are pushing to speeds of up to 130 miles an hour. He's running away from you. If you slow down, there's no evidence to indicate that he's going to keep driving at crazy speeds. All right? You also have his license plate. You know the owner of this vehicle. Elementary police work will find this guy for you, and you can charge him without any danger to anybody else.
The discretionary ministerial distinction in Kentucky law, as I take it, is not, you know, real literal. You have to have a ministerial obligation. It has to do with how closely you're controlled in your actions. And it sounds like when you look at these procedures and apply them, I'm sorry, these policies and apply them to the kinds of things you're describing, it sounds like the exercise of judgment to try to figure out what to do. Somebody's endangering the community, and we need to stop it. Go after him. But it's true. If it's a lot less reasonable if he's the one who's initiated this chase. But the chase was ongoing when he got involved in it. Is that correct?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that a subject's mere flight, you cannot claim, an officer like Officer Jones can't claim that the mere flight or the manner in which the subject is fleeing presented so grave a risk of harm that he had to be stopped, while at the same time claiming that his decision to pursue, to push that pursuit, played no part in the risk.
Fair enough. I see your time is up, and I have one question I'd like to ask.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Your opponent says that he raised the issue of state qualified immunity for the battery claim on page 25 of his brief below. Are you agreeing that he properly raised that below?
I'm happy to concede that issue, Judge, because I don't think he's entitled to qualified immunity on that.
All right, so you'd just rather go ahead to the question of whether there is.
Right, you don't get qualified immunity if it's a constitutional violation or if there's malice.
I was wondering whether it was waived.
Just one also final question that I think I had for both sides is, assume we disagree with you and found on the federal issue that there was no clearly established law. Our usual practice preference is to dismiss the state claims without prejudice to your refiling them in state court, and I was curious to get your reaction on whether that would be the proper course here.
I'm happy to try these claims in state court. I have a preference to try them in federal court, because if we try them in state court, we'll be in Bowling Green. And this, the bulk of this chase occurred through communities outside Bowling Green and Warren County. I think that's why Judge Stivers kept the state claims. He wanted to pull in people for the panel from surrounding counties who were actually exposed to this risk and let them decide whether they want this sort of thing to happen again.
Okay. Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. My apologies earlier, Your Honor.
No problem. Mr. Smith?
To address your question first, Your Honor, we would be comfortable in either state court or federal court on the state law claims. I would say that I think it's unlikely the case would be tried in Warren County because the majority of the pursuit was in Edmondson County, but that may be a jurisdictional issue for us to deal with later. But we don't have a strong feeling about that one way or the other. We're happy to try the case where it needs to be tried if we get to that point. Just a couple of things I want to address, Your Honor. You asked the question about why the window was broken out, and that was because the door could not be opened as a result of the collision.
Well, and break the window in order to open the door, presumably, is that the idea?
Correct. Or to be able to utilize his taser if he needed to, because he could not get, you know, compliance to his orders from CS. The key factor here is the ammunition in that vehicle that's thrown out. That elevates what you pointed out, Judge Murphy, the issue of officer safety, which is a big piece of the balancing test here. And you asked me earlier, without the ammunition and the threat of a gun, is this a different case? And I think I said, yeah, I think it probably is. And so I think that's a big piece of this here that makes what...
If they've thrown it out, how is it more likely to be there?
Well, it means that, I mean, where there's smoke, there's fire, Your Honor. So where there's ammunition, there's a gun. And why is it being thrown out? And a gun that could be loaded. And I think my officer is entitled to deference.
There's some possibility that the gun was thrown out as well, you're relying on.
Some, but I don't think my officer has to assume that the gun was thrown out as well. Nobody told him the gun was thrown out.
The fact that someone said it was thrown out would seem to be, if anything, cut against your case.
The issue of the gun being thrown out didn't come out until deposition testimony once this case had been filed. There was nothing during the pursuit that he learned about the gun being thrown out.
And there's nothing in the record as to who threw the ammunition out, right?
I don't believe there is, Your Honor.
CS threw it out the vehicle, or I think it's MS in the front seat, or Mr. Embry and as the driver.
I don't want to misspeak as to what
the... I don't recall saying anything.
I don't recall that either, Your Honor. And I certainly don't recall that it was said that CS specifically had thrown it out, but I don't want to misrepresent the record.
So under your argument, then, there's no tie in terms of a possible gun to CS. It's just that the argument is that maybe there's a gun somewhere in the vehicle that one of the three people arguably could have possessed.
Sure. The gun in the vehicle and a person hunched over with their hands concealed.
Okay.
And you put those two things in the mind of an officer on the scene making quick judgments, and his actions were objectively reasonable in that situation.
Can I just clarify real quick? Was I mistaken or correct under your view on where CS was sitting in the car? I thought I had seen some testimony that suggested he was behind the driver, but maybe he was moving back and forth.
That's correct, Your Honor. I think the testimony was that he was moving back and forth. I do believe that he was towards the driver's side at the time of the collision, but I think the most clear testimony is that he was moving back and forth across the back seat as observed by the officers.
Right. Okay.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel, both of you, for your arguments this morning. We do appreciate them. The case will be submitted, and you may call the next case.